Major sausage that is. Look at the state of it.
So, this is a podcast that involves talking of stuff. I'm the Doc. This is Bernie TB, who we occasionally get on the podcast to talk random shit.
You do.
Mr. Bernie.
Hello.
I have a question for you that I've been thinking about for a little while.
Is it one to which I can provide an answer?
You're under the age of 40.
I am.
You're a Richmond supporter.
I am.
How does anybody under the age of 40 end up being a Richmond supporter, given that they've done essentially nothing for my entire lifetime to warrant anybody becoming a Richmond supporter? This is something that baffles the shit out of me.
Long story short, the first AFL game I went to was Collingwood versus Richmond, my first ever trip to Melbourne. And I didn't know a lot about AFL at the time, but I knew enough to know that I could not support Collingwood.
That makes sense, right? That's
the only other option was to support Richmond, and now I'm stuck.
Because you're from Newcastle, aren't you?
Yeah.
I was wondering if this is some kind of massive reaction against having the Johns brothers rammed down your throat, not quite in Rex Mossop style, but in the fine city of Novocastria, and just thought, fuck this, I'm going to be an AFL supporter of the worst team I can think of at any given moment, which is generally, if not the Brisbane Lions, it's the Richmond,
Tigers.
Tigers, that's the one.
Tigers.
Leopards.
The other large jungle cat.
Yeah, the other. That's just something I was thinking about, because there is a chance that your team might be flying the Victorian flag at the pointy end of the AFL season this year, is there not?
I know, and it's another one of those things that I'm just waiting for it to all go horribly wrong, because it has to all go horribly wrong. This is the team that lost a final to the team that finished in ninth.
This is basically the Richmond way. This is the Richmond way, I understand. This is hashtag Richmondy. Yeah. I believe is the...
Yeah, the year we couldn't finish ninth, we still found a way to lose the final to the team that finished ninth.
And now there's that other team with the coloured sash swanning back into the consideration, I understand. They've all been forgiven for their various Rodney Howe-style indiscretions, and I was surprised by how quickly the acceptance of that has happened. As people have since gone, yep, no problem, you know, welcome back, Dons.
Yeah, it does seem to have been largely forgotten, doesn't it?
Yeah. Mind you, it probably was with Cronulla, but with Cronulla at least there was a bit of mea culpa. There was, you know, we fucked up and we're very sorry and we won't do it again. By the way, he's all our suspiciously overly large players going on to win the comp next year.
The premiership. We've got to go and put our porch lights out.
Yeah, Harold Holt's still, you know, he's still doing laps at the Harold Holt Memorial Baths down in Portsea.
Good times.
Good times. We are a little bit off topic with the code coverage, but we should. Breaking news that happened this afternoon was that the ARU have decided to shit can the Western Force because they're obliged.
I've only seen headlines about this. I've not had a chance to actually read anything about it. So what's happened?
So,
they've shit canned the Force and someone resigned.
Okay, so the head of the ARU resigned. So the dude, do you remember that hideous situation in Mossman where some fucking crank put a fake bomb belt around a girl's neck and threatened to blow her up because he thought he was getting back at
that
someone
was his kid.
And it was completely the wrong person? Well, her dad became the head of the AAU for reasons that I don't understand under any circumstance. And he's been really bad.
Well, there's a path to fame and money, isn't it?
Yeah, none of these events seem to have any sense or connection between them, but... he's presided over probably the darkest period in rugby union since professionalisation. Sounds a little bit like something Bob Hawke would have invented in his time as the ACTU. But so they were obliged to find a way to get rid of one of the Australian franchises under this plan to reduce the super umpteen to back to a super 15, but still to keep the Japanese and Argentine sides because they pay a lot more money. So the South Africans had to lose two teams and Australia had to lose one. And the AU have decided eventually that it's going to be the Force. Oh, and by the way, the CEO's resigned while no one's noticing at like 4:59 PM on a Friday.
Good time to issue that press release.
Perfect time to issue that press release.
Is this the point where I admit that I just do not give a shit about rugby anymore?
I went to the wrong school for that sort of stuff.
It has been so terrible for so long. I can't care anymore. Not even, I don't even know when the first blood is low is.
I'm not even sure. I can't remember a time when I did care. And even in New Zealand, I'm not sure people care as much as they used to.
Rugby has spent, what, the last decade shooting itself in the foot?
Yeah, well, there's no feet left. They've just got, it's just mince. It's just a pile of mince where feet used to be.
And shotgun cartridges.
Yes. They have a man to shoot them for, to reload the gun for them.
Because, of course they would, yes. Yeah, Niles. Niles would do it.
That's the kind of people we're working with here. Yeah, so that was, that's alarming. The thing is, of course, you know, rugby union being the kind of code it is, immediately Rugby WA are going to launch a High Court / Supreme Court case to try and prevent this from happening. So they're basically going to sue themselves.
They hung up the phone on the ARU and picked up the phone to the barristers.
Well, they're not short of lawyers in the old boys club, so they're just going to end up suing themselves into oblivion. And even the NRL, who were turned down for a large loan, I understand, this week, are in a situation where you'd think it would be an easy PR win for them to say, we should really look at a Perth team again. That would be a good idea.
No one cares about Perth, not in anything.
That's actually true. I should have thought of that. It's just basically a nuclear waste. Somebody said, you know, what would happen if WA got nuked? And I was sort of, the point was sort of, how would you tell? Most of it looks like the after photo anyway.
What would change? Nothing.
Well, there'd be a bit less flying in and flying out.
Well, presumably to drop the bomb, there'd be a bit of flying in and then flying out, well, but that'd be it, yeah.
The ultimate FIFO. I wonder if they'd be wearing high vis as they fly in. Could you put a little high vis vest on the ICBM?
Little hard hat just on the top.
we're really going to look like bastards when there's nuclear holocaust and we're all dead. This will be the one recording that's left of human civilization before the Holocaust. There's people laughing about fucking high-vis nuclear missiles. The Bulls podcast, people. Bezos is the only one who raises the tone.
It's the history Australia deserves.
Yes. Now, Bernie and I tend to talk a lot of motorsport when he comes on the pod, and there's a reason for that. It's because we like motorsport, and motorsport likes us, or at least it puts up with us, with our shit. Motorsport's at a bit of a crossroads, I suppose, with a lot of major factories pulling out of major international series in order to put their eggs in the Formula E basket. And this is kind of a hot topic in motorsport at the moment because nobody likes Formula E. It is bad to watch. It is not good racing. The cars are slow. It looks like Scalextrics in a car park. It's just, and the tracks themselves are horrible little street circuits. They have massive amounts of talent driving these dreadful little cars that aren't very quick. I mean, they've got less power than you go to your local airport rental thing and you pick up a Commodore, it'll have more power than a Formula E car. The problem with that is that that's very obvious when you actually watch the shit. Now, having more factories involved is going to make it quicker and better and improve the breed, but are the factories getting involved in this for anything other than just wanting to appear to be relevant rather than actually making any substantive change?
I think there's two things at play here. The first one is definitely that. It's appearing to be relevant. Electric is the future. Like, it just is. It's
future,
going to happen.
Future.
It's not going to happen for 30 or 40 years, but it's going to happen. It's just the way it's going to be. So you may as well get in and start doing that stuff.
Yeah. And certain factories have more
mass, mass adoption and all that sort of stuff is, when these things become ubiquitous, it's just miles away. And the whole electric autonomous car world of tomorrow is still a ways off, but the shit's coming.
But it's not happening in Gilgandra anytime soon. I mean, it might happen in the centre of New York, but it's not going to happen in fucking, you know, central western Queensland or somewhere.
No. The other thing is that, so the two manufacturers you were talking about before, Mercedes and Porsche in particular, have now dumped, Mercedes has dumped the DTM program, Porsche has dumped their LMP1 program in the WEC.
Which is awful because LMP1 was a series that we both enjoyed the shit out of, while it was sort of a three-cornered contest.
It had problems already that have now been forced to come to a head, but yeah. We'll get to that. But what going to Formula E allows these manufacturers to do is have a global motorsport program that's
still, as much as we might not like it, is still seen by a hell of a lot of people and costs them significantly less money to run.
Well, yeah, it doesn't have any footprint in the motorsport fan audience, but it does have a literal footprint in the casual fan audience because it literally rocks up in the middle of a city and it pulls a whole bunch of people in.
Yeah, and looking at the TV pictures, like the turnout at the races is actually pretty good.
Yeah, I don't think they charge much though. I think it's pretty much.
I don't really care. Like you're not going to charge much to a race. I'm going to get a turn up and watch it. I don't really care what it is. I'll go and race Hyundai Excel around Eastern Creek, and if you only charge me $5 to go and do it, I will go and do it.
Fuck, I used to go and watch fucking Eastern Suburbs Roosters games for $5. That's how desperate I was for entertainment for $5. This is back when I was living in Sydney. It was a long time ago, and I did many things I regret.
Don't we all? But yeah, so DTM was costing Mercedes somewhere in the order of 90 million euros a year. But
which makes no fucking sense.
The LMP1 program for Porsche was costing them, God knows, but if it was anything less
several
than about 200 million,
several hundreds.
If it was anything less than 200 million euro, I'd be really surprised. So what they can do is they can now go and race around the world in front of people and go, we have a global motorsport program. Oh, and by the way, it's also only costing us 30 million euro.
Yeah, it is. It's dirt cheap.
Which looks good on the bottom line of companies that
the thing is,
aren't making as much money as they used to.
It won't be like that for long, though, because as soon as all the factories get involved, and we saw this, you know, 15 years ago in Formula One, all the factories got into Formula One, and then it was just a huge headlong rush to make stuff, and then all of a sudden, whichever factory, and Paul Stoddart was famous for saying this once, he said, I'm Bernie Eccleston's best mate. You know, he really loves having me around, because if it wasn't me who was coming last when he was running Minardi, it'd be a factory. And the factory would be told by its board, get the fuck out of here. We're not paying all this money to come last. And then another factory would end up being the one who was coming last. And their board would say, we're not paying all this money to come last. Let's get out. And that's pretty much what happened with Formula One. You had all these factories that came in, like BMW and Toyota and Renault were in and out. And obviously Mercedes, they're still in. But, you know, they all came in. They saw they were conquered and they left. I wonder whether we're going to see the same thing with Formula E, is that you've got all these factories in there. Someone has to come last, and they're not going to like coming last, even if it isn't, you know, it'll start out at 30 million a year, but it will become much more expensive as the powertrain development becomes a proper race.
Yeah,
Formula E's probably going to have the
really
same boom bust cycle that we've seen in every great motorsport that we've ever had, like Formula One, IndyCar, LMP. They've all had that boom bust structure.
Yeah, quite possibly. Like the onus is going to be on the organisers to set up a structure of the regulations around it to try and contain that, because we know and we've seen that some element of cost capping in a popular formula actually works. It used to be the way in LMP2. That series grew and grew and grew, and they built a structure of regulations around it that enabled levels of development so you could keep improving your cars, but didn't end up costing you hundreds of millions of dollars to do that.
And ironically, now that they've capped a lot of what you can do in LMP2, where that development has that control development has happened is over in the American series, where they've taken the LMP chassis as a starter point and said, right, factories, you can put stuff on it, you can put your own engines in, we're going to balance the performance in anyway, so it's not going to really make a lot of difference. But they've turned out some fantastic racing as a result of it. And as we've discussed in other media commitments, that could be an interesting way for the Le Mans people, ACO, to revisit their LMP formula for time to come. If they look at that IMSA rule set that the Americans have cooked up.
I have a really strong suspicion that despite that being the thing that they really should do, they're not going to.
No, because they're French.
Because they're French.
Yeah.
Because it's the ACO. But the other thing with the WRC is now, what's Toyota going to do?
Oh, they've got to go. They've got better things to do. I threw out the idea that they've got a chassis that would work perfectly well in DTM. They've got a car that would work perfectly well in DTM. They've got a full factory team based in Germany where DTM lives. Why not just go into DTM? Now, the response to that seems to be, but DTM's imploding and will disappear, which I didn't really take seriously, but it does seem to be a thing that people are talking about a lot. And that is a bit of a shame, because it's unnecessarily expensive, as you've pointed out. I mean, 90 million bucks is an awful lot of money. I don't know how much of that is people's salaries, but it's much better racing than V8 supercars, for example, because cars can actually go past each other. And, you know, it's not just Roger Penske's people winning all the fucking time. it would be a shame for that. And DTM will get replaced by something else, so it doesn't really matter. But
yeah, that's the thing. So Mercedes pulled out of DTM, and that's left Audi and BMW as the last two manufacturers in that. And there's going to have to be something to do there as to whether they're happy to keep pouring money into a series where it's just the two of them.
Well, there was only two manufacturers in DTM for the time. They
bring Toyota in and see how, you know, Toyota might not be interested in doing that, although I quite like your theory.
Well, the thing is that the DTM are supposed to be moving to 2-litre turbo engines like Super GT in a rule set that starts might be next year or the year after. And that's actually going to be a spec engine. That becomes a lot cheaper. The monocoques are frozen in terms of there's nothing worse than having your monocoque frozen, I realise. But it shouldn't be as expensive as it is. I think part of it's because they've got such an expensive array of talent that they keep paying. That's the way it is. But DTM has only had two factories for quite a long time anyway. It had Audi and Mercedes there for quite a long period of time. So it can survive with two factories, but they really should be looking at pulling in any factory with a vague interest. And that's why Toyota seems like a slam dunk, because they already have a car. You know, they've built it. They've developed it. It's got the aero. It you know, they've even got one that will fit the 2-litre engine. Just get them to fucking send six of them over on a ship. It's probably not high enough profile on Toyota's interest. I don't believe Toyota are that interested in it, but it just seems like a really obvious thing to do. But the other thing is that the Japanese aren't really that interested in Formula E either. I mean, there's no Japanese outfits in Formula E. Super Aguri were in the first season, I think. They had a team in the first season. But it wasn't
I remember
a Honda team, and they fucked off back to Super GTs pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, for a manufacturer, you've got, at the end of the day, your motorsport program is all about selling cars. And you've got to be asking yourself, how many cars is sinking $70 million into a DTM program actually going to sell for Toyota in Germany?
And how important is it? Or it'll be Lexus.
Toyota or Lexus. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, how many cars was the LMP1 program selling for Toyota in the first place? I mean, it's all about marketing. Toyota's motorsport headquarters being in Germany is probably the biggest element of that fit. And if their motorsport headquarters was in frickin' Latvia, then it wouldn't actually work at all. The other team that the other manufacturer that keeps being suggested for DTM and or Super GT, given the kind of pseudo shared rule set, is Volvo, which makes no sense at all. But that's something that popped up in commentary in the last Super GT round, so make of
Volvo,
what you will.
Made no sense for Volvo to turn up in the supercars, and they did that, so.
Well, yeah, I don't really know what they thought they were doing there. But, I mean, they and Honda are both deep in the World Touring Car Championship. I guarantee they're selling no cars off the back of that, because nobody gives a fuck about the World Touring Car Championship. It's just...
No, I've only watched one World Touring Car Championship race, and it was at the Nürburgring before the 24.
Yeah, I watched that one. I also like the round at Vila Real, which is the ridiculous street track in Portugal. That's always good.
I meant to watch that, but I only saw the onboard clip of old mate collecting the ambulance.
Yes, come for the food, stay for the ambulance. And the other one, it used to be good when they used to run Macau, but they don't do that anymore. I think that's now a TCR event.
That would have been, that was hilarious.
No, it was because eventually someone would crash into a safety car or something completely pointless. We will see how that turns out. So,
the other thought I had is that, you know, your motorsport is about selling cars. It's a marketing exercise. So you want to go into series where there is at least perceived to be a little bit of prestige, and a domestic German touring car series doesn't carry a lot of prestige. An FIA World Championship, even though it's a terrible one, does.
I don't know. I would have thought the DTM would have had better ratings.
It's not about ratings and TV audience. It's about, at the end of the day, if you win Formula E, you get to come out of that and say, we are the world champions.
Oh, in Formula E, certainly, but not the World Touring Car Championship.
You win GM and go, we won German touring cars. Yay, us, I guess.
No, leaving DTM it's odd that Mercedes would leave DTM. It'd be like Holden leaving the V8 supercars. I would fully expect Mercedes to come back. I think that felt like a price signal. That felt like you guys need to make this a shitload cheaper, because it's fucking ridiculous that we're spending the money we're spending to run Dodgem cars, particularly given that the British Touring Car Championship is basically a whole bunch of taxis that smash into each other, and they pull enormous crowds. And massively entertaining, ridiculous and stupid. But it goes back to that, the early to mid-90s in super touring era British touring cars, which, of course,
I have Toka touring car
games. But it
I have fake memories, courtesy of the Toka touring car
game. Exactly, but it was like every factory you could imagine had a works team, because it was dirt cheap and it was really even because there wasn't a lot of aero. But then as time went along, you know, by 2001, all the factories had quit because it cost too much, and the FIA had got hold of the rule set and fucked it all up, and it was all just too expensive and too convoluted, and they all got sick of losing. So all that was left was the factory Vauxhall team, and then Vauxhall pulled out. So, and now they've got this kind of hybrid kind of super privateer formula. But that's kind of the problem with courting manufacturers, is that they're at the whims of the boards that decide that it's a good idea. And they don't come in because they love the sport. They come in because they either want to develop technology, if they're Honda, or if they want to promote their wares, which is everybody else. I mean, it's really only Honda that go racing in order to train their technicians and improve their technology as the first priority compared to marketing and promotional stuff.
Yeah.
And that's to their detriment. And that's why their Formula One program's so poor, is that they keep doing that thing they used to do in the 80s, whereby they would have they'd just rotate their technicians through the program. So no one's there long enough to learn anything and have any institutional knowledge.
Yeah. I don't know why they bothered coming back to Formula One. What a waste of time.
It made too good a story, I think. You know, it was just such a good story, you know.
Well, and there was so much promise too. There were stories about McLaren, that Honda had actually built a Formula One car to mule the engine while they were developing it, before they announced that they did the process of coming back in and having all the restrictions placed on them by the series. And it was like, oh, cool, you know, Honda's doing this thing and they've sort of built a car, so, you know, there's a possibility that they might come back as a full-on factory thing. And then they arrived, and then, yeah.
Look, they can't even build a Super Formula car. And the Super Formula car is just basically a chassis from Dallara that you stick your Super GT engine in. And even then, they're slow. So, I mean, I just saw a thing with Pierre Gasly complaining that the thing was too slow. How do you fuck that up? I mean, literally, this is the problem with Honda. They suck at everything they do at the moment. They suck at Formula One. They suck at Super Formula. They're not very good at Super GT. They won the last round, but they'd been beaten by Lexus in the previous five. They suck at IndyCar. They suck at World Touring Cars. They're getting beaten by Volvo. They suck at fucking... They're going to try and come into IMSA next year with Penske, who, you know, because they're a bunch of Mormon Cybermen, will fucking ruin everything like they always do. You know, they even suck in global rallycross. And they suck in ways that you haven't even thought of. Now, I
how
don't
are they going in MotoGP?
How a manufacturer can take as many L's as Honda have. But that's what they're doing.
Maybe they just like racking up the frequent fly miles.
Frequent L miles. That makes no sense at all. Do you think that maybe telling someone to suck your balls on international television is a good career move?
I'd say it probably depended on the context of the program on which you were saying that.
What if you were Kevin Magnussen and Nico Hülkenberg had turned up in the middle of your interview to drag you for turfing him off the track for being a big chin German fucktard? Do you think that would be a good time to tell him to suck your balls? This is one of my favourite things about
it. It's probably not the best time, but I'd be struggling to think of a worse time.
I'd go the other way. Can you find a better time? This is kind of something a theme I was thinking of watching the last round of the Formula One, because we're now in the Formula One summer break. And it was a little bit of a sort of a case study in how to be a good teammate. Now, we know what happened with Dan Ricciardo and Max Verstappen. That was a case study in how not to be a good teammate. You don't, you know, get beaten off the line, get beaten in the first corner, and then come barreling up the inside and smash your teammate's radiator and knock him out the race. Generally, that's not being a good teammate.
By and large, yes.
By and large, I think so. Whereas Lewis Hamilton, completely unexpectedly and out of character, put in a little case study in how to be a good teammate. He asked to be let past. Well, bloody Bottas chased off after the Ferraris, couldn't catch them, and in the end gave back the place that he'd been given from bloody Bottas, even though it would have been justifiable for him not to do that. And that's obviously something he's hoping will pay off further down the track. you know, when he needs Valtteri to move over for him, you know, it's in Suzuka or somewhere closer to the end of the season. My argument will be that Kevin Magnussen was the ultimate teammate of the Grand Prix last time. Because what happened on the very first lap of that Grand Prix was that Hülkenberg cannoned into Grosjean of Haas and stuck him, you know, flicked him into the air and got him out the way. And there was a little bit of radio commentary from Magnussen who'd seen this saying, if that's how it's going to be, then it's absolutely on. And a little bit later in the race, Magnussen turfed Hülkenberg off into the weeds when Hülkenberg was trying to come past. And hence, Hülkenberg turned up in the press pen afterwards to try and show him up in front of the live interview and got told, suck my balls, mate. So I think the Teammate of the Year award should go to Kevin Magnussen. If you see a man getting turfed out of the ruck, you go in and you sort the dude out. And that's exactly what it is.
The Golden Balls. The Golden Ball Award.
The Golden Balls Award.
Kevin good Magnussen. Man.
Scandinavians are good. I was trying to say Felix Rosenquist, but it was going to come out as Helix Frozen Piss, and that's not right. That's problematic. That's not what I'm looking for. I was going to say Felix Rosenquist. It's one of those things you get stuck in your head and you can't get it out. Because I was watching Formula E and he was in the championship hunt because he's racing for fucking Mahindra. But he finished third in the title. But every time the commentators call his name, I keep hearing it as Helix Frozen Piss. And it's hard not to fixate on that.
Anyway, we need to get him in the supercars along with Helmet and Two Girls.
Helmet, Two Girls and Helix Frozen Piss.
Frozen Piss. That's going to bring the kiddies back to touring car racing.
Well, are the kiddies anywhere near touring car racing these days? Where is... I haven't been to a Viet supercar event in a while, but are things going all right with the code, do you think? Or one of the things that rugby's obviously suffering, most sports are suffering a decline because people don't go to events anymore. They stay at home or they go to the movies or they don't even go to the movies anymore. Every live event-based sport is suffering from a decline. I mean, we were talking on the internets today about the fact that NASCAR is dying in the arse and fucking no-names like Kevin Hardwick, the former Balmain prop, are blaming Dale Earnhardt Jr. for having a shit year and therefore their series is having a downturn. You know, like you can base the fucking popularity of your series on one dude. You can kind of hinge it off that. That's fucking insanity. But all these sports are in struggle town. In terms of eyeballs and punters and people through the gate and all that sort of stuff and advertising revenue. So I can't remember what my point was, apart from...
How are the supercars doing?
Supercars are doing basically the same kind of shit too, aren't they?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I've actually quite enjoyed watching it this year. Okay, a lot of the racing, individual races can be pretty ordinary.
Yeah, it's either a Penske procession or it's a Red Bull procession as a difference.
And it is. But watching that sort of back and forth over the course of the season, I'm finding fascinating, like how this is going to resolve itself at the end when we come to the goat track in Newcastle.
I'm looking forward to the goat track in Newcastle. I reckon that would make a fantastic Formula E track because it's got the right combination of narrow and pointless.
It does. Maybe that's the next pitch. Once the supercar series gives up after about 4 years, because that's probably all it's got there before the money runs out because people don't want to spend money on that shit street race, Formula E will be the next thing. It'll be like when the Gold Coast lost Champ Cars.
Well, the thing is that...
And tried to bring in A1GP.
Well, I reckon A1GP would have been amazing around there. Because A1GP...
It would have been fixed.
Because they had bigger... They had fucking big, like, 1970s-style rear tyres. They had huge asses. They would have been a real handful through that first chicane where you end up right over near the tyre wall. In those days, it actually was just a wall.
Yeah. Yeah, no, those cars would have been a handful. And what really would have been the icing on the cake for that race is the fact that the field had basically no talent in it.
Well... They had talent, but all the talent was 12 years old. If you go back and look at the dudes who were in A1GP, they've all popped up elsewhere. You know, like Adam Carroll was driving the Irish car, and Robert Wickens was in the Canada car, and fucking various Kiwis were driving the Kiwi car. The Kiwi car always tended to win. Neil Yarny was in the Switzerland car, and fucking Like Duval was in the French cast. So there's lots of talent, but it was at a very early stage of its development. And putting them in a like something that was marginally less powerful than a Formula One car with mass. And the one thing I really remember from watching the very early A1GP, early rounds, was how much the cars moved around in a way that the drivers clearly didn't want it to. They would wander around in a straight line because they had these massive amounts of rubber and massive amounts of power, and these guys had never driven anything more powerful than a Formula 3 car. It was spectacular in a way that Formula 1 just wasn't in the same era, because that was the era that Formula 1 was doing that you have to have the one set of tyres for the whole race kind of shit.
And
it was
Yes.
And it was, I think
it was the shit era.
It was Schumacher era. It was, we're going to try and do anything to stop this guy from winning, so we're just going to make up new rules and hope for the best. But it was that the fucking, the first half of the 2000s were a fucking nightmare.
The dark times.
It was, you know.
It was not good. And A1GP was stupendous because it had that. So you had young drivers in these cars that they could barely control. And they'd
on
either,
tracks that were the, not designed for them. I mean, they used to race at places Zandvoort. Which was totally mad. Brands Hatch! They ran these things at fucking Brands Hatch! Which is, you know.
And then they'd turn up at places in China where you physically, no matter how good a driver you were, you physically could not get the car around a lap.
There were places that made the Canberra street circuit that the V8 supercars used look like fucking Sepang, you know, 12 metres wide. It was just insane bullshit. Absolutely insane. But the thing is that people get nostalgic for old forms of motorsport. I mean, are people nostalgic for the V10 era of Formula One? I'm like, yeah, they sounded great. But that was the era that Schumacher won everything and the cars were on groove tyres and they could only have one set of tyres per race. The racing was shithouse. The cars sounded fantastic. I was reading the most recent issue of Motorsport magazine and they had a special on the Ford Sierra RS500 Cosworth saying statistically this might be the greatest ever racing car because it won such a great proportion of its races. It also fucking ruined the sport. It made it incredibly boring to watch. It's just that with time and rose-tinted glasses, I mean, nostalgia will make you believe anything was better than the stuff that we've got right now.
Well, even going back even further, old, really old F1.
Yeah,
like
we don't have video. We don't know how bad it was.
One of the great things about Foxtel was that they spent a lot of time pulling stuff out of some archive somewhere and putting it on the television. And you're watching these Grand Prix, you know, these great Grand Prix, these supposed to be great Grand Prix, you know, Senna's great wins and all this sort of stuff. And you sit in and watch a race, and it's so boring.
Yeah, because he destroyed people. He won by miles. And it was like, okay, this is great. This is like watching fucking Matty Hayden scoring 380 against Zimbabwe. It's an amazing performance, but fuck, it's boring. There's no competition involved in it. It's just a man kicking a dog. And some of those center races were exactly like that. The hand-to-hand combat, the racing component was not as common as old heads would have you believe.
Well, no, and that view gets distorted when all you see are highlight clips of the good bits.
Yes, that's exactly right. Something the same's true in any sport. I mean, the fact, you know, that, oh, footy was better back in the 80s and cricket was better back in the, you know, that's it's just old heads just being old heads, really. I mean, I'm very aware that there are some forms of motorsport that will never be as good as they are right now. We'll never have LMP1, right? Le Mans Racing is at a high point over the last couple of years. It won't be as good as this again for a long time. Super GT at the moment is fucking amazing. It's incredibly good stuff. And DTM is really good right at the moment. And it just won't be that good again for a while. So you kind of have to take stock of things when they're at their high point and remember to appreciate them while they're there, because everything goes in boom and bust cycles, particularly in a very commercially vulnerable sport like motorsport that's very susceptible to the whims of corporate boards.
So, yeah, I kind of like that GT3 has got all these customer programs and stuff like that, and you can still go pro-am racing because that does insulate it a little bit.
It does, and that's the only...
From that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But even that now has become... You know, all the big races are all factory teams going out, whooping the rich old guys. And, you know, pro-am is a euphemism for rich old guy.
Yeah, yeah. Cashed up fuckwit. Yeah. But I think Stefan Rattel gets a lot of shit, particularly from John Heindorf and company. But he's very good at figuring out the old rich guy audience and figuring out just how much massaging they need to still keep underwriting the Enterprise. I mean, fucking the Spa 24 had 63 cars. They couldn't fit any more cars on the grid. And his events, I mean, GT3 seems to be the, apart from Formula E, seems to be the only international motorsport that is not contracting but expanding. I mean, there's going to be a new SRO 10-hour Suzuka race next year. There's going to be a new 12-hour Hampton Downs New Zealand round of the endurance series. There seems to be something that there's an audience for, that there's growth for, and it's probably tells you a little bit about how wealth has been concentrated in the hands of various rich dickheads. But there is a market for this stuff.
And there is. What they're going to have to be careful of now is a few manufacturers are starting to come out with GT4 cars to sort of woo the rich dickheads away from GT3 with the promise of, oh, you'll actually, you know, be competitive and be able to win your race. You're not going to go out there and get blown away by a factory team.
Well, I think that's fine because there's always more rich dickheads, and the rich dickhead, I mean, a GT4 car isn't a lot slower than a V8 supercar. In fact, if you wanted to build a real, you know, the next, the thing is that V8 supercar will always be a home built, Australian made fucking tube and frame thing. They'll never buy anybody else's rule set. Not after Group A kind of blew up in Australia's faces, but they can do a lot worse than just adopting the fucking GT4 rule set, because that's perfectly quick enough. It's just that they would get beaten by their own support series every weekend. Having said that, they do that anyway. Anytime they have Formula 3 on a V8 supercar bill, anytime they have GT3 on a supercar bill, they're not the quickest things on track. So I don't know where series like V8 supercars go.
It's an interesting question because we're already in the era of the, you don't have to run a naturally aspirated V8 sedan.
Yeah.
Like, that rule set is already in play.
Because there's just nobody who sells one.
It's just there's nobody running anything else. So
there's nobody who makes and sells ones in Australia apart from maybe Jaguar or somebody.
I don't make any cars.
Once Holden finally pack up their tent, there won't be anybody who makes and sells a naturally aspirated V8. Certainly not one of 5 litres.
No. So, but what's going to happen, probably not so much next year, but the year after. So 2019, you know, 888's already doing their V6 twin turbo based off the new Commodore, which is an old Commodore, which is a throwback to the original Commodore, which was an Opel, which was whatever.
Yeah, but ironically, Opel is now owned by fucking Peugeot Citroën. So they're still doing it under, they're still making Holdens and Buicks, because that deal makes them money and it also works out for them.
And the V6 turbo engine comes out of the Cadillac, whatever
Cadillac GT3 program. And that's I think that's what Nissan want to do. They want to bring the GTR. And that's not a bad rule set whereby you just go, right, everyone build a chassis, stick a GT3 engine in it, off you go. In an odd kind of way, it's a little bit like a parallel of the IMSA DPI formula, which is basically buy a chassis from Orica or Ligier or whoever, stick a GT3 engine in it, go racing. And that's pretty much what the Ligier Nissans are. That's pretty much what it's not quite what the Dallara fucking Cadillacs are, but it's certainly, that's the model. That's pretty much what's happening everywhere else. The Orica Hondas that Penske are going to run are basically running the 3.5-litre turbo out the back of the NSX GT3 car. So it's odd that you're getting international rules convergence, but not quite in the form of intact racing cars. It's bits of racing cars. It's the engines. It's the chassis. It's things like that.
The thing for the supercars is that there's no real, there's nothing in the wind about anyone else doing that yet.
Yeah, nobody wants to. There aren't rumors.
So what's going to happen in 2019 is that, you know, everyone's basically going to retire the current supercar. So the 5-litre V8 sedan, gone, goodbye. And so what are we going to left with? We're going to be left with a grid of 888 Commodores?
No, I reckon what you'll have is it'll look a little bit like British touring cars, whereby you've got the factory, factory-supported people who are running like a Holden chassis and a Holden engine, but you've also got people who are building other manufacturers' cars, getting licensing deals for the badges, like Betty did with AMG, and running the series default engine. So with British touring cars, they have there's a Toka engine and a Toka suspension package you can run, and you can build up like a fucking AMG Mercedes or a Toyota Avensis or anything you want, and you can run the bits that are kind of Project Blueprint style default to the series, and that will make you competitive with the factory fucking Subarus or whatever else is in the series. In BTCC, there's like factory Subarus and factory Hondas and a few others and a few some BMWs and things. But you can either do the default template or you can go factory. But either way, it kind of gets balanced out with ballast and all that kind of shit. Anyway, I kind of
but feel that, like that's
how that V8 Supercars is going to end up.
That requires the series having that sort of template. I don't think Supercars is that smart.
But they've always had that template. That was what Project Blueprint was like 15 years ago. They standardized all the parts in the cars apart from the engines.
But that's not the case now.
But they'll go back to it. I mean, that's pretty simple. They'll have a standard chassis. I mean, I understood that the chassis was pretty much standard. You just bolt your. I mean, that was the tricky part about building a Volvo out of it, was trying to make the Volvo, which is quite a bit smaller, the bits of the Volvo fit onto the chassis, which is kind of the same. The underlying structure was kind of the same size, regardless of whether you're running a Falcon or a Commodore.
Yeah, but you got that because the cars were relatively the same shape. The cars aren't the same. Don't have to be the same shape.
Yeah, you're not going to build a Corolla
anymore. So there's a couple of there's a little bit of, I get the idea, but there's a little bit of sort of massaging and sort of working things out that you'd need to do in order to be able to provide that sort of basis to be able to run privateer outfits off.
Yeah, the model would end up be a lot more like Betty Clemenko's inverted commas Mercedes AMGs, which were not really supported by Mercedes. AMG Customer Sports sent over some people to build an engine, and they gave them Mauro Engel, which, you know, was nice of them to volunteer to ruin his career to the point where it took him several years to build it back up again. He won a DTM race by accident the other week, which was quite funny.
Did he?
Yes. He just happened to, he got super lucky with a safety car and he won, and it was kind of, you know, I wasn't disappointed because it ruined my. Because every time he fucks up, I always say, I've been watching Mauro make mistakes all weekend. Unquote, Shane Van Gisbergen.
The only bit of DTM I've seen this year was Gary Paffett trying to kill Mike Rockefeller at the Norris Ring a couple of years ago.
That was a fucking mess. Although, the problem is the first corner of that track is like this flat out sweeper that kind of undulates. And they just kind of undulated into each other, and then there were parts, and it was bad.
You couldn't really see the start of the accident. The first thing you saw was Gary Paffett disappearing at 90 degrees to the rest of the field into a fence.
Haven't actually hit each other, or whether it was just Paffett lost it on the undulation trying to get around the outside of Green, and then it was just...
Yeah. And then it was just, he just speared into the fence and then slid all the way down the fence into turn two, which is, of course, a left-hand hairpin.
Yes.
And straight into the front three-quarter of Mike Rockefeller. Yeah. And did his ankle, I think.
Broke his foot, I think. Lucas Degrassi style. Lucas Degrassi, of course, won the Formula E title with a broken leg. This is ridiculous because he raced in a doubleheader at Formula E after doing a little hairline fracture with his leg. The week later, turned up at Le Mans and failed the medical, so he couldn't race at Le Mans because he had a broken leg. And he's like, but I did two Formula E races last weekend. So that's bad. Don't do that. I can't remember what he did it, do we?
Open wheel cars are easy to get out of than a coupe prototype, I'd imagine.
And it's not like he was going fast enough to hurt himself in a Formula E car. Well, I think we've
solved... Where to now?
I think we've solved many of the problems of society. Do you have any problems of society that you need to solve right now that you think you can solve in the course of a podcast?
I don't know. Probably. There's probably some problems I have of society for which I'll have solutions, but they're solutions that I'm going to remember in about 45 minutes.
I get the impression that the problems of society that are solvable on a radio context are ones that are not going to go terribly well, you know, particularly with somebody who... built their brand around being a member of the Bolt family.
If only I knew back then.
Well, this is an interesting problem that we both have, is that I think we've both built our online personas around comic characters that neither of us really want to fucking live in anymore. It's a little bit hard to live up to the standards of the kind of reactionary bullshit that I was supposed to be spouting on this under this handle. But it's a little bit hard to sort of build nuance and intelligent commentary into a handle that says, I'm a steaming bogan with a PhD.
I can't respond to that. I've got nothing.
The self-analysis was a bit too deep there, wasn't it?
It's too early on the Friday night for the existential crisis.
Oh, it's never too early for an existential crisis. You'll find that.
It's probably about time we should have the obligatory mention of the Bunnings stage of the old Rally of Australia.
Did you know that Bunnings started as a forestry firm company in WA?
No, I didn't.
Now, this is the thing. With your campaign to get WA nuked, which I understand and I support provisionally, but that means there's no more Bunnings forestry stages. That means they're just going to be known for being a large shed that sells parallel imported shit from China. Is that something you're prepared to stand behind or beside or near or around the corner from? So you can get the takeaway hot dogs from?
Yeah, sure. Fine. Maybe we can come back and Bunnings can buy the nuclear wasteland and we can just have the entire... we could have the Rally Bunnings in the nuclear wasteland that was WA.
This is going to sound so bad when this happens, you know. People of Guam are going to be so pissed off. See, I thought Guam was already wiped out when fucking George Michael left and there was only that other bloke. Yes, recycling my Twitter content.
Oh, that's not a good joke.
Everyone should ask for a refund. Look, this is...
I want that 20 seconds of my life back. Thank you very much.
20 seconds? About 55 minutes. I think that's as good a time as any to wrap this show up. This was the Bulls Podcast with myself, the Doc, and guest Bernie TB. Bezo will be back next week, so... thank yourselves. You can follow us on all the social medias at The Bull Podcast. You can follow Bernie at BernieTB and myself at Dr. Yobbo. Any final words, Bernie?
I only come on this show so I can keep my number of appearances above Aaron's.
Yeah, fair enough. And you will notice...
It's 3-1. I'm not allowed to get the ratio worse than that.
You will notice the subtle change in new and little nuance, the change in tone that happens when Bernie's on the show compared to when Aaron's on the show. It's almost indetectable.
It's a bit more real now, real. I feel.
All right, Bernie. Thanks for coming on. Catch you again next time.
My pleasure.
Once again, of course, at the board of drivers, set my balls clean. Yeah, they're really good, man.
We've come up with amazing... This is the After Dark, folks. We've come up with an amazing business plan. And the pretext of this plan is that if you're dead, you can't sue anyone for defamation. So sledging people who are dead is a fantastic way of releasing stress. But say you're Rupert Murdoch and you've got a corporation that's going down the toilet for $100 million every time you open the door. And you're about to die because you're an old cunt. What if you sold the rights to sledging you after you're dead with defo rules out the window for $2 a pop? Who's in?
Yeah, how many of those would you buy? Because I would buy a lot just to have in print saying all those things about Rupert Murdoch that you really want to, like, enshrined in print forever. Yeah. You could frame it. Put it up your mantle.
What about all the people with the fucking the Murdoch Times fucking Twitter handles and stuff like that? Imagine how much you could clean those guys out for. All the people with the Dames and Knights fucking Twitter handles, no matter the fact that
Dame Knight Squire
years ago. You imagine how much you could clean those people out for.
Imagine how much you could do it if you were Fairfax.
Well, it'd be like giving my swear jar. It'd be the
marketplace of ideas, right? He's dead. You can't be sued for defo. So if you're Fairfax, you go, oh, we'll do it for $1.50.
Oh, you think it'd be a race to the bottom? Eventually, the Batuta are going to be offering it for like 33 cents, which is about exactly their market value.
But, you know, imagine that not just Rupert, like anyone. So you have your little obituary section in the paper, and then you turn the page, and it's just like obituaries, like but response, the defamatory version.
The response, the return of serve. It's like he was a dedicated church elder, and a keen Rotarian. Turn the page. He was a cunt. He burned my fucking lawnmower. No, that's not appropriate.
But that's it. We fix newspapers.
I've ruined it for everyone.
So are you listening, Greg Highwood? I'm pretty sure you're a fan of the podcast. You can have that.
No, we don't have friends in Highwood places. We've only got friends in Lowood places.
Under a hedge somewhere.
Generally, people who listen to our podcast can't get Highwood. They have to use blue pills.
Oh, so you've got the NASCAR problem then. Your audience is old and dying.
Yeah. I know that I've whinged about this on other social media commitments, but the idea of blaming the dude who's the most popular dude in your sport for the fact that your sport's not popular enough is like, there's so many other reasons your sport's fucked, and it's not him. It's not just the fact that he's having a down year. It's just dumb.
No, NASCAR's got the same problem that baseball has, is that the audience is getting old.
The audience is getting old, they're not getting replaced.
Yeah.
What are you going
to
do?
They're doing nothing to bring the kiddies back to stock car racing.
It's because the kiddies have got better things
Which,
to do.
Just imagine that sentence. One of the France family has said that in a boardroom. They just go, "Oh, we've got to bring the kiddies back to stock car racing."
Bring the children back to stock car racing.
Everyone else, the 30 other people around that table have just sort of stared at them because that is the dumbest thing you can say. We need to bring the kiddies back to stock car racing. How the hell do you do that? No one cares. No one.
Well, that's the problem with everything. No one cares about anything.
An insufferable bore fest.
Unless you made... What if you made NASCAR tracks out of Minecraft? That'd get the kiddies back.
Yeah, no, that'd bring all the kiddies back and you'd make $1 squillion.
Although it's hard to build a track with just squares. It looked like a particularly... It looked like a fucking... An American street track of the 80s. You ever seen a straight track map of the original Detroit circuit that they used to race around Formula One? It looked like they'd drawn it on an Etch-a-Sketch. It was literally up, down, up a block, down a block.
I found myself on Google Maps at work the other day looking at Birkfront Lake Airport.
Cleveland, the old IndyCar track.
In Cleveland, the old Champ Car track.
That was tremendous. I saw Robbie Gordon and Michael Andretti hit each other after the race. Like, just well-bang, and they were just fucking sledging the shit out of each other.
I know where I found it. Someone has uploaded, the entire 1999 Kart World Series on YouTube. The entire broadcast of all the races as a massive playlist.
That was a good series. Midnight Charlemagne ending, though.
I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch that. Because I'm pretty sure I watched it, in 1999.
Would it be a spoiler to tell you that it ends with a draw?
No.
Okay.
I don't know how it ends.
Yeah, ends with Greg Moore doing himself in, which is awfully sad, but not on purpose.
Oh, God, when did that happen?
Fontana, it was the final round. It was a nasty somersaulting crash. I think I don't really have a clear memory of how he, biologically, physiologically, how he came to stop functioning as a human, but I suspect he got a head injury. It might have been like a cervical dislocation, a bit like... Dale Earnhardt Sr., his neck got wrenched so badly it actually kind of, snapped his neck at the base of the brainstem, which is what did for Dale Earnhardt, which is why everyone has hands devices now.
Yeah, not that I go out of my way to watch it, but every time I sort of see footage of Earnhardt Sr.'s crash, I always think it didn't look that bad.
No, it's just because his head went left, right, left so quick. It did for him. But it was the sort of crash that now with a hands device that would have held the helmet in place, and it would not have been a drama anywhere near the same extent.
Oh yeah, no, of course. But I just I remember that, and that was.
But they were humming
it. That was 70 years ago.
That was in the days when it was.
Remember things like we've all seen Ayrton Senna's crash and other crashes. Greg Moore was another one. Justin Wilson more recently.
Yeah, I've never seen that.
And it's like there, and well, even Felipe Massa's crash at Hungary in 2009, 2010, whenever it was. Like, those were violent, violent crashes.
Yeah, your man Jules Bianchi going under the JCB. That wasn't...
I don't think there's any vision of that, thankfully. I don't want to watch it.
Thought you could see him slowing off in the background, but I might have just imagined that in my mind's eye.
Or I've deliberately avoided it because I don't need to see that.
No, exactly. The thing is that some of the most violent accidents I've ever seen,
when you tend to stop functioning as a human being, as you put it so eloquently, in a motor race, it tends to be a really, you know, violent, like, obvious, you know, like Dan Weldon's accident, you know, was just violent, and you knew it was bad, and you get that sort of sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach that something's gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Car went into the fucking catch fence. But then he copped a steel, like a steel pole in the head. That was the end of him. No kind of fucking halo was going to bring him back.
Yeah, but then you compare that to Dale Earnhardt's accident, and, you know, like, by comparison, it just didn't look that bad.
Yeah, but the thing about it was the particular, it was a side force, and it was a side force with an unprotected concrete wall, because, of course, there were no safer barriers in those days. And they killed a lot of people with those things. I mean, Richard Petty's grandson was killed in a not dissimilar kind of way a year or two before Dale Sr. went. And it was all about the fact that there was no side protection, and the drivers were too close to the wall, were too close to the door, which was going into the wall, and you know, all the dumb things that were around in those cars, because they were still space frame shitboxes from the fucking early 90s by 2001. So they made a lot of changes to get the drivers away from the edge of the car and fucking strengthen the side impact and get the hands device and all that sort of stuff. But unfortunately, you know, it usually takes a couple of losses of life to make any fucking difference. And sometimes you get massive overreactions, like the halo and the fucking aeroscreen.
Oh, God.
Which is not much. I'm yet to see, I'm yet to hear anybody who this would have saved in any kind of convincing argument.
I really wouldn't be surprised if that actually doesn't happen. If that it becomes one of those things where everyone goes, no, it's happening, and everyone goes, oh, well, actually, no, it's shit, and I hate it and would rather not, and then it just quietly goes away.
Well, I thought like that was going to happen with the halo.
Oh, no, they're talking about it happening, but I kind of feel like it's going to become another one of those Formula One ideas that they used to have a lot of under Bernie Eccleston and Max Mosley, where we're going to do this, it's going to be great, it's going to be fantastic, and then it kind of goes away and you never hear of it again.
I mean, like, well, and some of them, they last for a year and then they go away. Remember when they used to run qualifying like a massive Hardy's Heroes? Like, they would run, like, 20th to first. They'd all have, like, one lap. That happened.
Oh, yes.
That actually happened.
This. And then they figured out, first.
Because they were desperate to stop Michael Schumacher from finishing on pole every qualifying session. So they thought, maybe it'll rain one day.
So they engineered a qualifying system that was basically going to guarantee him finishing on first. Because what they did, you ran first to last in the championship in the first round. So you all did, everyone did a hot lap.
It was
starting,
two rounds.
Starting with Michael Schumacher and going all the way back to Fernando Alonso in the Minardi.
That's it. 2002, 2003?
Something like that.
No, two. And then, it was two because he won for Renault in 2003.
But then the second round was run based on your qualifying time in the first round from slowest to last.
Yes.
From slowest to fastest. So, you know, Michael Schumacher basically went out, did a lap, fucked off for an hour.
Went for a smoke, got a burger.
Tucked into an ice cream, whatever it is for drivers to do when they're not
when
racing.
Skiing. Oh, is that?
and then they'd come out, and so Fernando Alonso would basically go out, do his first lap, come into the pits, put another liter of fuel in it, go out and do his second lap.
He might as well
then,
just got out in the golf cart. Just going, I'm done. Fucking off. Is there any surprise I didn't watch Formula One in the early 90s? Because there was a union of domination by a guy I fucking hated, and a whole lot of really bad ideas, like this, and like the tyres you couldn't change. And it was just a clusterfuck of stupidity.
Remember the 2006 Indianapolis Grand Prix?
Oh, we haven't built tyres for this.
we've turned up with flyers.
Nobody told us there was banking
for this racetrack.
Well,
no,
we may have slightly overstepped the bounds of what is possible on a track with banking.
No. Apparently, it wasn't the banking. Is what the Indianapolis Motor Speedway had done? Had gone and done the whole diamond cut grooving thing to it.
Oh, so it was massively gripped up.
So it was idiotically gripped up, and that's what. So because they'd run it for 2 or 3 years before that.
Yeah,
and it had been fine, but between the previous Grand Prix and that one, they'd made modifications to the circuit, which included going through and cutting grooves in basically all the corners to increase the grip, and that's what did Michelin in, is that they didn't expect that sort of thing because they'd never come across it. Like, it doesn't exist anywhere aside from maybe the start line at Spa.
And and maybe at a shitty American street circuit that's built on concrete. You know, the Grand Prix of Houston or something that's held in the car park of the fucking football stadium.
I'm still staggered that ITV won a broadcasting award for that race.
Well, it's grading on a curve. It's like, how do you make a race that just is basically a parade? It's you know, it's like televising Goodwood.
If memory serves, half the broadcast was Martin Brundle chasing not Martin Brundle, he was in the commentary box. Whoever the pit lane reporter was at the time, probably Ted, chasing Bernie Ecclestone. Lumsden, yeah.
Lumsden Bumhat. Slotover.
Theodore Slotover.
Your man Slotover.
Trying to chase Bernie Ecclestone around the paddock, trying to...
Saying, Bernie? The fuck is this?
Basically.
Don't you dare cancel my fucking paddock pass. What is going on? And it still took another 10 years to get him out the fucking paint. It was amazing. There was a man that was harder to dislodge than a congealed stool.
It took a new racetrack to get the race to get Formula One back in America.
When was the last time Herman Tilke had an idea that wasn't shit?
Turkey.
Yeah, and the irony is that politically no one can go there anymore because Turkey's fucked. So running the East's greatest achievement is in a country that's turning its disappearing up its own face asshole. Oh god!
That's doing that, and prior to that, had absolutely no money to attract top class motorsport,
and nobody was interested in going. In fact,
no one wanted to go there. Yeah.
The greatest Turkish racing people that I can think of, the dude from World Supersports who wins all the time, who's a knob, Kenan Sofoglu, who's a fucking knob. There's a dude in fucking GTEM, Sally Yolick, I think his name is. He's like an Aston Martin dude in GTEM. I think he goes well at mostly ELMS, but he ran Le Mans. I think that's it. That's Turkey. Yeah, Turkish motorsport.
Possibly no Turkish racing drivers, like none.
Yeah. That's the best I can do is one. It was Sally Yolick. That's all you got. You probably don't need a Herman Tilke designed motorsport road venue. I think you'll be okay. But it's just a shame. Circuit of Americas is a dog of a track. And
the problem is, and this is kind of like the problem with a lot of Herman Tilke circuits, is that when you play them in video games, they're actually kind of fun to drive.
Yeah, but they're a little bit like video games in that, you know, with a video game, you have like the first stage and it's easy, and then the second stage is harder, and the third stage is harder yet. That's a bit like how he designs the track. You remember like the fucking Korean track?
It was straight
to the first part, and then it was gentle curves to the second part, and then it was like ridiculous twisty shit for the third part. That brings me to a point. The number of abandoned Tilkodromes around the world must be going up and up and up. You got Turkey,
India.
India. I'm sure they still use India for local stuff, but you know, they can't be going that way. Korea is basically overgrown and ruined. It's Dunsky.
Remember when that track was going to be like, it was basically going to be Abu Dhabi, but in Korea?
Yeah.
They were going to build it. It was going to become a street race, and it was going to be, you know, like apartment buildings and nightlife and sort of like Monaco and a little bit of Abu Dhabi.
Marina and everything.
But what? It was a track full of 90 degree fucking corners next to a container port in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Yes. And what it was close to was a fat man who wants to start a nuclear war. And that's not good for business. There is no...
Mate, Korea's nowhere near America, you fuckwit.
That's true. I saw an Asian GT round there like a year or so ago, and it was amazing to see how overgrown and fucking ghost town it was. When I was still racing there, it was clearly... It looked like it was a little bit post-apocalyptic. It was astonishing. The grass was too long. The marina was decrepit. Oh, it was fucking amazing. It was tremendous. But, you know,
other talking to people out there.
They just don't seem to have a culture of motorsport in the same way the Japanese do. I mean...
I'm now going to Google Herman Tilke racetracks and see what comes up, because I actually can't remember how many...
There are a lot.
I'm sure there are a lot.
He's been involved in pretty much everything that's had Formula One involved in it. Like the revised Hockenheim.
Everything seems about Malaysia. Was Malaysia
that was his most successful. Which is ironically, it was his up probably because he did that 20 years ago. So I reckon that's one of his better ones.
Here we go. List of circuits: 1985. He did the 81 ring.
Bad.
Sepang.
It's okay.
Bahrain.
Sandy.
Shanghai.
No, that's no good.
Istanbul.
That was good, but it was almost like a greatest hits package of other tracks.
Apparently, he designed one for Cancun that was undeveloped.
I can't imagine why that would be.
The Beijing International Street Circuit, which I have a feeling was the A1 GP race.
Yes, and that was horrifying. Oh no, it might have been the even worse one they did for Formula E and the first race of Formula E.
No, this was in 2006. No, this was the A1 GP race.
That was not good.
They couldn't get around the hairpin.
Yes, that was fucking. And Tim Schenken signed off on it because he was clerk of the course for all that fucking A1GP shit. He's like, yeah, we'll do that. Tick. I signed off on Canberra. I can sign off on this.
The Bucharest ring.
No idea. I know the Slovakia ring. I don't know the Bucharest ring.
The circuit held two FIAGT meetings in 2007, 2008. The 2009 event was cancelled due to financial reasons. Shock.
And it is now a car park.
It was supposed to host AutoGP, but that didn't happen, and now
fucking
it's...
AutoGP.
It was...
AutoGP was made out of the abandoned cars from the third-generation A1GP, which were the ones that were... So the reason A1GP went to the wall was that Ferrari said, we'll be your partner. We'll build cars that were based on the fucking the 2003 Ferrari Formula One car. Problem is, it was all horrifically expensive, and A1GP couldn't pay the bills, and it all went tits up.
Here's a fun fact. Guess who owns the lap record for the Bucharest ring?
Oh, God.
Bear in mind, this held two FIAGT meetings in 2007 and 2008. Guess who holds the lap record?
That'd be GT1, would it?
It would be, yeah. GT1, GT2 possibly as well.
No, I got nothing.
Brendan Hartley.
In what?
It doesn't say what he was driving, but it says he was racing for Carlin Motorsport in 2008.
Oh, that'd be, that'd probably be more likely to be fucking Super Formula or some fucking piece of shit. Some weird fringe,
Major events include the FIA GT Championship, Formula 3, FIA GT3, Auto GP, and the Dacia Logan Cup.
I reckon he was probably in
F3
when he did that. No, AutoGP would have been much quicker because they were more like A1. They were basically A1GP cars, so they had much more horsepower than a Formula 3 car.
AutoGP never raced there. The race was cancelled.
Oh, okay. Should have won Formula 3.
So it must have been Formula 3.
It's a long time ago. So that was back when Hartley was a fucking Red Bull Junior.
He must have been, what, 5 years old?
He would have been a tiny, spindly little blonde kid from Palmerston North, which is exactly the same as what he is now.
I love
the fact that he and Bamba used to go bashing at Bamba's fucking farm, ended up winning the fucking Le Mans 24 Hour together. That's really cool. That's a bit like
New Zealand's fuck you to the world.
But that's a bit like in fucking, what was it, 41 years ago, Bruce McLaren and Chris Amon, who had not the same relationship but a similar kind of relationship, fucking won for Ford at Le Mans. And it's nice that these resolutely small-scale human connections can still perpetuate through to something as massively corporate as the Le Mans 24 Hours with a Porsche LMP1 program. So Bamba's going to stick with – Bamba's still got a GT contract for next year. I don't know what Hartley's doing, but
I thought they said the drivers were going to Formula E, so yeah. He's probably going to turn up there.
I would have thought that he's certainly quick enough.
Back to my list of Herman Tilke circuits. So the Bucharest ring was he built that in 2007. 2008 was Marina Bay, so Abu Dhabi,
which is awful.
Also in 2008 was the Candavas Kartodroms. I don't know what that is.
He's building go-kart tracks?
Yeah, no, it's a go-kart track in Latvia.
What, did somebody have photos of him in a compromising position? Or
presumably. Here's Valencia.
You fuck my daughter, I make you do kart track in Latvia.
The Valencia Street Circuit.
Look, that as a street circuit, that didn't suck entirely. Mark Webber will tell you otherwise because he almost disappeared out of the mortal coil backwards and upside down.
That was an impressive accident.
Yeah.
He has also done the Lipo Village International Formula Circuit.
That sounds like a golf cart track for retirees at Sanctuary Cove. What, Liposuction Village, was it?
Is a temporary street circuit located in Lipo Village, Tangerang, Indonesia.
The truck was confirmed to host a round of the 2008-2009 A1 Grand Prix season.
Oh, that one. The 2008-2009 A1 Grand Prix. Yes, I'm sure that one happened.
Yeah, memory says that.
I feel like this was a licensing job. They just sort of said, you can use the brand, but don't involve my name.
2009, yes, Marina. 2009, he did Aragon.
Yeah, that's not... The first part of that lap is crap, but...
The second part of that lap is quite good, where it goes up and down the hill.
You know, I know they use that a lot for Le Mans testing, and they just pull the chicanes out and just go like hell down the straight, and I feel like that would be more fun. It would be almost like a weird Spanish Bathurst, but it's...
Is Aragon the one at Portimao?
No, Aragon's the one in Aragon. Portimao's the one in Portimao.
No, that's the weird one in Spain. That's right.
Aragon's the one that's literally in the middle of nowhere, and it just goes up a hill and comes back down a hill.
That's right. That's MotoGP go there.
Yeah, MotoGP go there. World Superbike go there as well. It's I haven't seen a lot of car racing on it. I've seen a lot more bike racing on it. It's not a bad bike racing circuit, but the reason it isn't is because it has a long straight going into a fast final turn, and people can go barrel.
It's also 50,000 meters wide.
It's wide and it's hilly. It's got kind of a weird, overly tightened reverse Laguna Seca corkscrew on it. Which is kind of Tilke's deal, is that he goes, oh, I'm just going to steal that idea and build it somewhere else. I mean, like, the best parts of that Turkish Grand Prix track were bits he'd pinched from somewhere else, but they all...
Except for that three apex left-hander, whatever it was, turn eight, which was just
a phenomenal
bit of track.
That was an interesting bit of overkill. But the best part of that track was the was just an old-fashioned idea. Have a straight... And a dirty, great, big, almost flat-out kink over the crest of a hill, and then a straight down to a tight-as-shit, twiddly bit as the last corner of the lap. And
yeah.
That worked so well.
I remember watching, I think it was the year Lewis Hamilton won GP2, and GP2 was stupendous that year.
Yeah, that era of GP2 was mad shit. It was...
I remember watching that one, and just... Something happened and someone started at the back and they just spent the whole race just carving everyone up, just lap after lap, just down the inside, around the outside, just throwing it everywhere. And it was phenomenal. And then, like, the next race, they went to Monza and it was the whole field doing that into every single corner. It was one of the best car races I've ever watched. Anyway.
The one shame is they can't lift up that Turkish Grand Prix track and put it somewhere else where, you know... Kurds aren't being gassed quite as much. And we can actually get on and do some, right? You know, the sport can continue and people's human rights can't be infringed. So
anyway, in 2010, Herman Tilke designed a Dublin street circuit, which was never developed.
Well, that surprises me.
there's no pitches. Also in 2010 was the Korea International Circuit, now laying in ruin.
That was a shit job. It was literally three straight lines and some twiddly squiggly bits.
If memory serves, they turned up at the first year, they'd barely finished laying the road, and then it rained.
I was shocking. It was literally, don't go off into the undergrowth, you won't come back.
Well, that was the year Mark Webber lost his chance to win a Formula One World Championship.
He dropped it.
He binned it around the back of the lap somewhere, and that was the end of his season, just about. He just never recovered.
That's exactly what happened, and that was as close as he ever got, and I'm sure he's over it. I'm sure he doesn't spend his nights staring at the ceiling going,
I could have... Well, he's won a championship now, so.
Asterisk.
Also,
by the end of
Moscow
this year, Earl Bamber will have won that championship.
Moscow Raceway, which I think I watched a World Touring Car race at once and have absolutely zero memory of.
It gets used in Blancpain and DTM a bit. So they had the DTM round. It races well in DTM because it's got a Tilke finally figured out, I know, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you have a long back straight and a sharp final corner, you know, people will think it's a good track because there's overtaking opportunities.
He's also done the Kazakhstan Motor City.
Oh, that's good.
The link on Wikipedia, there is no link to that on Wikipedia, so I'm guessing it
was deleted.
Doesn't exist.
You will not look at Motor City.
Atlanta Motorsports Park?
That sounds like it would be an oval.
It is not.
How does he build like a first gear hairpin into a fucking oval? Atlanta,
I don't know, but the main
road course. Atlanta, because Road Atlanta is actually a one of those old fashioned American road courses, which ridiculously quick and have far too little runoff, and are the reason.
Is that where they do? Is that where they do Petit Le Mans?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, Atlanta.
But the hidden. I mean, you think of American racing, and you think, oh, fucking NASCAR, and then IndyCar. But the IMSA guys go to some amazing tracks like these, particularly when they have these GT only rounds, because they find these tracks that are too small and narrow for the prototypes to go to. So they go to like Lime Rock and Virginia International Raceway, which are these amazing fucking ribbons of tarmac through these paddocks, and they wouldn't be homologated in any other country apart from America, whereby you know you do everything at your own risk, fuck off, you know.
I've been saying for a while that I don't really understand America's obsession with oval racing, because they have some of the best actual racetracks in the world.
Yeah,
over there.
But so you've got things like
Watkins Glen, Road Atlanta, VIR, Laguna Seca,
Road America.
Road America.
Even Ohio's good. Yeah.
Like, dead set, guys. Like, the rest of the country needs to discover right-hand corners, because they're really good.
Well, they're undiscovering NASCAR pretty quickly, so there's always the opportunity.
Yeah. I mean,
people are losing interest in NASCAR awfully quick. The problem is that these tracks are too small. They're too difficult for... They're not tracks you can put an IndyCar on, because people will literally get killed. You know,
not anymore. I mean, Kart used to race at Laguna Seca.
Oh yeah, Laguna Seca, they'd be fine at. But you know, Sebring, they just have they'd vibrate themselves to death.
Kart used to race at Road America as well, and
they do. IndyCar races at Road America.
Do they still? Oh, good.
Yeah. There was a Scott Dixon one, I think, which is ridiculous because the Hondas are nowhere near as quick as the Chevys. But Scott Dixon just did his magical fuel-saving magic, managed to beat the Penske Chevys. Actually, a pretty good race.
This is my problem, is that I have absolutely no time to watch anything.
You don't think you've got time. You'll find time. The
I enjoy things like sleeping.
The fucking the Xfinity series are going to Road America in the next couple of weeks, I think. See, the next week or
I am going to have to find time to watch that, because that's going to be hilarious.
Because they were at Watkins Glen last week, because the NASCARs were at. Everyone was at Watkins Glen last week.
Watkins Glen, one of two road races.
But the Xfinity guys do a shitload more road races. Like, they do.
They're doing it. I know they used to. They used to do things like they went to Montreal once, and they went down to Mexico.
They still go to Montreal. I think that's still on their schedule. But they just did Watkins Glen, and they're doing. I don't know whether Road America is next weekend, but it's they've got three more. They've got three road races in 4 weeks. So they've got it's, I don't know the order, but it's fucking Watkins Glen, Mid Ohio, Road America, and Bristol in 4 weeks. So within the same 4 weeks. So.
And then presumably they're going to Sonoma at the end of the year.
Oh, they've already done Sonoma. They do Sonoma earlier in the year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought it was later in the year. No, but, just what I know about the NASCAR schedule.
IndyCars do Sonoma late. They do that as this season. So they kind of swap the relative positions of Watkins Glen and Sonoma.
Anyway, after Atlanta Motorsports Park, Herman Tilke went on to the Bud International Circuit, which is India.
Which is also fucking... This is where he came up with the idea of the ridiculous first corner. Because that one has a first corner that goes up a hill and comes back down again.
Was this where he debuted the massively long straight that became spectacularly narrow about 150 metres before the next corner?
My recollection of that track
was it the other way around?
My recollection of that track was that it raced pretty well. It was actually not as awful as some of the other ones.
I remember literally nothing of that circuit.
The last time I saw anybody racing on it was over the summer. There's like an Indian, a little bit like the New Zealand Toyota Racing Series. There's like an Indian like MRF tires series, and it's the same kind of idea. You have pseudo Formula 3 cars, and people come out and race. And I think Mick Schumacher and a bunch of other people went out. They must race around India, but I think they've only got one track that's suitable. I must have seen some highlights of people just fucking up around that Indian track. And again, it looks a little bit overrun and decrepit, but you get that. So it's still a usable, raceable racetrack. It hasn't been completely abandoned. It's not the sharpest condition. they're not going back there anytime soon, particularly given that Force India are about to rename themselves Force Not India.
Force all the other countries.
Force anything other than the in the country that our dodgy boss, who might be going to jail, doing very bad things.
Please don't seize our assets.
Assets by Force India.
By Force, comma, India. Yes. Next on the list was Circuit of the Americas.
Which took like 1,000 years to build because the finance fell over for it 47 times, and Kevin Schwartz was part of the project to start with, and then by the end of the project, he'd been fucking trespassed from the site and wasn't even allowed there for the first Grand Prix of the year. Like, he turned up and got escorted off the premises by fucking security.
So if memory serves, discussion of Circuit of the Americas started about the same time as discussion of Circuit of Wales. And at least one of those tracks has now been built.
Yeah. Well, Circuit of Wales is properly dead now, I understand, because the Welsh government, the Welsh Assembly have said, this is a bad
no.
idea.
No.
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 I am not going to do that.
I'm not going to do... No, that's Irish.
My Welsh accent is shit. all you have to say is boy-o.
And then there was the Port Imperial Street Circuit, which was a 2011 plan for a 3.2-mile motor racing circuit.
Sounds like a tobacco brand from the Caribbean.
In get this, Weehawken.
Where's
Weehawken? It's in New Jersey. This is the...
Was that Bernie's failed attempt to build a street circuit in Jersey?
Is the correct answer.
Because the Formula E made a big song and dance about being in New York, but it was in a shitty part of New York in the docks where... It could have literally been in any industrial city in North America. At least
it was in the car park for a container terminal. It was a bit like Valencia, really.
Yeah. But the thing about Bernie's concept for New Jersey was, okay, it's going to be in New Jersey, but the backdrop is going to be Manhattan. You're going to be able to see Manhattan in the background and all the establishing shots. And I think Formula E missed that because they couldn't do that with the way that their track was laid out.
They also got given a hectare of tarmac that they could actually build a racetrack on.
True, they just sort of went up and back and then up and back. And that's the biggest problem with Formula E is that they do it on these ridiculous little car parks, and they have these little up and back and hairpin riddled circuits. They make the race fucking awful. Now,
the problem I have with it is that I actually really don't mind watching Formula E. Like, I kind of enjoy it in the same way I really enjoyed A1GP.
Yeah, but A1GP was quick. The cars were spectacular. It was quick
and it was stupid, and at the bottom end of the field there was absolutely no talent. The thing I like about Formula E is that because basically you can't pass, you get all these really quite decent racing drivers. The grid is sort of brimming with pretty decent talent.
Helix Frozen because
you put them in this ridiculous situation.
They all get really frustrated, so they bomb it
down the inside, and they're constantly knocking like wings and wheels and all this sort of stuff off, and it's great.
Well, you know how people talk about the BMW Pro Car Series, or the like when they used to put all the Formula One drivers into identical BMW M1s in like the 80s, or like there was a laser series where they put all these up and coming race drivers into matching fucking Ford Lasers in Australia, like Mark Scaife and David Brabham and that, and they just bash the fucking door handles off each other because they have these massively talented people totally overdriving shit boxes.
Yes.
That's Formula E.
That's exactly what it is. It's entertaining.
It's a pro-celebrity race.
No, that's exactly right. It's great. It's entertaining. It's terrible, and it could be better, and it will get better.
Well, the thing is,
especially as the manufacturers come in, they're going to want it to be better.
Well, the problem they're going to have is that clearly, the organizer, Alejandro, who's the boss of the series, wants to leverage this fucking USP he's got, which is we can go into the middle of cities and we can build tracks in the middle of cities and bring it to and have one day events. That's the thing he wants to do. The factories will come along and make his cars too fast to work on tracks that are built in a day in the middle of Paris, because the cars will quickly outgrow. They won't be able to build a track slow enough to make sure the tracks are still in homologation for safety reasons, basically. That's going to be a challenge. Do they keep going along the path of let's make them further, faster, fucking longer, or do we still try to keep this, we can bring the circus to the middle of your city kind of thing? Because they're not going to be, if those things become as, currently they're about as quick as a Formula 3 car, if they become as quick as, say, a Formula 2 car or an Indy car, then you're not going to be able to run them in tracks like the ones they've been running in the last year or two.
No, but I think their first problem is overcoming the whole pitting to change cars thing.
See, I don't mind that because it's got a strategic element. If they take that away, they're going to need another strategic element.
But the problem I have at the moment is that everyone has to pit at the same time. Like, the cars will only do half distance.
Well, like, that's been the case this year.
Don't have a choice.
That's been the case this year. There's been teams that have been, like, Lucas DeGrassi won the race pitting ridiculously early in Mexico and just sort of eking it out ridiculously. I mean, he basically pitted 20 laps into a 55-lap race sort of thing and just dribbled it home and somehow managed to win the run to the flag. As the car's range has been better, that kind of strategic element has been better played out. Now, when they're only running one car for the whole race, I feel like it might kind of revert in strategy and be a little bit more like those Formula One races where you couldn't change tyres. It'll be more...
I don't want them to go the whole race, but I kind of feel like my perfect world would be you'd have two cars that could do 55 or 60% race distance, like easy. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of where they are now.
Do you go out and do you go Berco for, you know, you sort of go Berco and eke out your second car so you sort of pull ahead and then get caught up, or do you do the reverse? And I feel like that would probably introduce a bit more strategy to it.
Well, they couldn't have had a better year in terms of because they started out with fucking Sebastian Buemi, who is uniquely unblessed with any charisma of any racing driver I've seen over the last sort of fucking 10 years. He is incredibly unlikable, but he dominated the first half of the year. But then, of course, with various problems and you know, clashing commitments with Toyota, he got caught up by Lucas DeGrassi and then managed to have the greatest dummy spit I've ever seen on camera after race one in Montreal went badly for him, where he literally walked down the pit lane hurling abuse at every driver who'd cut him off or looked weird at him or had ever sledged him in a press conference.
That was a beautiful 15 minutes of television, and my congratulations to whoever it was in the production truck that just stuck with it. The cameraman who was walking alongside him.
That was Dario Franchitti in the comm box just going, this is the best reality show I've seen all year. This is tremendous. Because they just go, and he went one of the Andretti guys, and then he's like, and then the Andretti mechanic said, it was the other one. It was Robin Friends. It wasn't the cost. It went over Robin's. It's like, yeah. What the fuck do you want? You know, I've driven into you, or we could have just, you know, what do you want? And then he went off after fucking Abt's kitty. It was the funniest shit.
It was great. I was having a really good laugh.
And that's what will make the series.
And you could just see Dario Franchitti just like sitting back in the commentary box and just enjoying the spectacle.
And it was that will make the sport. I mean, the two things that make people interested in sport, as far as I'm concerned, are the spectacle and the narrative. The spectacle being, is it cool to watch? You know, if you're watching, you know, dudes going up for a big mark or fucking rallycross cars dancing around or do someone hitting a big six or whatever it is, the spectacle is what draws you in, but the narrative is what keeps you, the human connection, the stories. You know, Sebastian Buemi's a fucking knob. I want to see him fail. That's a narrative that you might follow. Or, you know, I really like, on the American side, they always do those fucking sob stories about the player whose, you know, parent died and, you know, he lived in foster care and, you know, fought his way up and got a scholarship and is now fucking running back for the Dallas Cowboys or whatever. You know, it's those, the spectacle gets you in and the narrative holds you in terms of when you get interested in sport. And there was fantastic elements of both spectacle and narrative in that Buemi explosion. And I'm kind of disappointed that he subsequently walked it all back and apologised and said, you know, Lucas DeGrassi's a worthwhile champion. I would have been much happier if he said, that fucking bastard, he deserves fuck all. I'm the best guy and I'm going to come back and smash him. If he goes totally WWE, he deserves
it. You just see him walking down the grid at the first race of next season, just like holding a folding chair. Just starts laying into DeGrassi.
Not the leg, it's already broken. Yeah,
actually, there's an idea to change up the Formulary TV broadcast a bit. Let's bring in the WWE commentators.
Yeah, actually, the one thing I'll say about WWE is that the production values are tremendous. They cover it really well. Bob Vasher appears to have woken up from some kind of fucking Valium-induced slumber and doesn't really know what he's doing there. But whether it's Haven or Jack Nichols and
Dario's ex,
they're really good. Nikki Shields is a little bit wasted because she's actually a motoring person. She's got her own fucking web series about cars and stuff. But all they have her do is like interviewing the fucking celebrities, like Kate Upton with her tits out.
Yeah,
hello. Great. You could do more with her than just that. But
I'd actually like to see Daria do something else, like maybe go back and call an IndyCar race or something like that. Just
I think because he gets paid really too much to sit on the sideline and tell Max Jones not to crash. Like, Max, you're shit. Stop being shit. You fucking deckhead.
This is probably true. But I really enjoy his commentary. I actually quite enjoy Martin Haven as well.
Well, I do. I mean, Haven alternately really interesting and really frustrating. And I think it depends whether it's 3 a.m. in a 24-hour race because he gets really strident and he gets fixated on certain points and won't give them up. There was one right at the end of the Spa 24. He and John Watson were in the booth together. And
John Watson's insufferable.
But both of them together, like both individually I can deal with. And I don't mind Waddy, but together they were just reinforcing the old man shtick. And it was just, and they were getting shit fucking wrong. And there's nothing I hate more than commentators getting shit wrong because they were fixated on the idea of the fucking 65-minute stints. And they're saying, well, they can't make it to the end because it's, you know, three multiples to 65 minutes left. And it was like, but the pit stop isn't counted in the 65 minutes. You go 65 minutes. 2 minute pit stop, 65 minutes, 2 minute pit stop. That's more time. They've got enough time to do it. And they just kept reinforcing this fucking wrong, stupid thing. And I was like, you stupid fucking old white people, get it right. So I understand I have issues, but I'm working through them. Thank you for listening.
This is good.
And that's also why I can't stand listening to John Hinoff, because he gets stuff wrong and relentlessly, unapologetically repeats it over and over and over again, and that's why he's so bad. I do appreciate that Radio Le Mans exists, though.
As do I. I would not watch nearly as much car racing as I do.
True.
If I hadn't got listening to them.
We've accidentally done a second podcast. That wasn't popular. And have we finally solved the mystery of what happened? Did Herman Tilke, you know, like Oasis, sort of drop off after three good albums, or was he always shit to start with? Like Blur.
I don't know. So basically.
Is that all of Herman's tracks?
There are a couple I have absolutely no idea about and couldn't pronounce, and then you get to Azerbaijan.
Oh, is the fucking the circuit of human rights abuse?
Of course it is.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
How do you design a track that is literally just the streets? It's just like we went up,
presumably you choose which streets to use.
Okay, otherwise you end up with Canberra. That's basically how Tilke gets these jobs. He just carries a picture of Canberra around.
That was an idea. You got cars to do this. Someone make a street circuit. Yeah. Hey, Mark Skate.
What do we need a designer for? Have you seen this? This is what happens when you don't. You know, with a wheel bouncing down the fucking road.
Still the greatest supercar highlight ever.
Still the only supercar highlight. That and Dougal McDougal ending on his roof and Barry Sheen giving it the major, major sausage that is. Look at the state of it.
I think that's a good back to end things on.
I think so too. This was the After Dark, apparently. We didn't review any albums because we were never going to. We'll catch you next week.
Yeah.
Bye.